Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome to the NIDS View, where we examine the strategic frontier shaping our national security and global leadership. It's me, Jim Petrosky, president and co-founder of NIDS, and I'm delighted to be hosting the show while Adam's on assignment and Curtis is, his whereabouts are really unknown. At least that's my story for now. Anyway, today we're going to turn our attention to space, not just as a domain for exploration, but as a pillar of American preeminence. And as the landscape evolves, sustaining leadership in space requires more than technology that puts us there. But more importantly, it's the people that get us there. And surprisingly, it's not all rocket science and rocket scientists. So today we're joined by Dr. Brandon Tolliver, a recent NIDS senior fellow and a very active one. And by the way, thank you so much for all the work you do for NIDS. Seriously, Brandon. He's the author of an insightful paper. It's going to be coming out soon called Harnessing Interdisciplinary Expertise from Non-Traditional Industries and Academic Institutions to Sustain U.S. Preeminence in Space Exploration. It's a lot to talk about, but it's soon going to be published, and you'll get a chance to read that, right, Brandon? So
yes.
In this paper, Brandon's going to bring a unique perspective that most people think of space as rockets and everything else. I think of it as the people get us there. And so, Brandon, it's certainly a privilege to have you a member of our organization, privilege to have you on the show. So I'm going to turn it over to you to tell us a little bit about yourself and what inspired you to write this paper. We'll go from there and talk about the importance of space and the people that get us there.
All right. Well, first, I'm very glad to be here, and it's an honor. Likewise, to be named a senior fellow to such a kind of prestigious organization that I kind of was. So I'm very proud, and I wave that banner proud. A little bit about myself. We already know my name. I just recently took a position at Tuskegee University. I'm the vice president of facilities and construction. What does that mean? That means all the buildings, all of the 5,000 acres that make up campus and property.
I didn't realize it was that big. Why is it so big?
Well, that's a good, you have to ask Booker T. Washington. I don't know why, but that also includes the airfield, the Moulton Airfield.
Yeah, that was my properties. Point.
Yeah. But the main campus is still 240 acres, and I've been here only for a couple of weeks, but it's been challenging, and it's given me a chance to kind of pull everything together that I've done my entire career into one position. So it's good days and bad days, but being here kind of helped me start to think about things a little bit from an academic perspective, but still thinking strategically. So when we're talking about space and how to remain the preeminent source, or thinking about strength and deterrence, and then being the best, we don't have that gap that we used to have. So the easiest way to catch up is thinking about education and how we can find alternate sources of intellect or of ingenuity. And that's kind of what made me start thinking about this paper, is how can we not spend a lot of money, or spend the money that we're already spending, but look in alternative sources. And
that's a great idea. And I love people. That's great. I love people think out of the box. You know, when you think about space, for many years, especially in the military, you know, we just think it is another operational domain and everything has to fly through mm-hmm. it. But if we want to make a preeminence there, maybe part of what we're looking at is it's more than a scientific, you know, frontier. It's basically from a military aspect, contested domain. And there's a lot of, mm-hmm. you know, maybe some things you can talk about is how you thought about where, you know, where people come from and, you know, how we sustain a role in space, not just with satellites, but with people. I mean, it's a complex problem, and it's a lot of people have to be involved in different ways. What are your thoughts on that?
So that was a big brainstorm, a lot of paper, a lot of post-its all over the wall. And you can probably see my dry erase boards, trying to figure out like what were the points that I wanted to talk about, because you can really talk about anything, because it's so many things that go into this, to what we could consider space dominance. And if you're thinking about from a long term, somebody's up in space at the space station, there's sustainability, there's biotechnology, there's hydroponics, there's things, people that work out in all of these farms out here in Tuskegee, all of that plays a role in that. And I started thinking about George Washington Carver and all the different things that he did with peanuts and with sweet potatoes and with all of these different elements of the earth, but he found ways to utilize them in non-traditional ways. So that kind of led me to thinking about, well, what if we had programs in the university and in all universities that fed into the talent pools and the areas where we need to really focus on in order to maintain the space dominance. So just like we have programs to, somebody makes a commitment and they join the military, but they go to school and then they owe a certain amount of time after they serve, you know, after they graduate to serve. What's to say that model can't be applied to space or to the development of things in space? So just thinking along those terms.
Yeah, the interestingly, and I'm sort of break from my show prep concepts and throw something at you, because I was recently in a meeting with a group of people, we were talking about civilianizing certain government functions, and you know, it leads me back to NASA, where NASA used to be sort of the belly button of almost all the space work, and I understand why we've commercialized a bit of that space and actually outsourced that space mission. But there's a lot of concern about the people, you know, the sort of the scientific mind bleed from NASA that's now going out into other places. And you lose that focus and you lose that control. Was any part of that brought into your paper? And what are your thoughts on that? Because I agree with you. You know, I always tell people, especially at the maybe undergraduate level, a little less, you know, my philosophy is, you learn a lot in your undergraduate field to be able to do things. But when you go to a graduate, especially a graduate program, you know, if you graduate from a graduate program and you're looking for a job, your industry failed you, your university failed you, and you failed yourself. Mm-hmm. Because when you're leaving a master's program, somebody should be looking for you for a career. And, you know, you're talking that career part right there, which I absolutely agree with. There should be careers, a pathway forward. So, you know, students should know, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. I mean, here I am, you know, 63 years old. I'm doubly retired and I can't put this down. I can't stop because it's so much fun, but it's also, it's part of my DNA and you're trying to build that. So right, you know, maybe did you cover any of this concept of whether, you know, whether space becomes NASA or space becomes part of DOD or space just becomes part of the commercial world as well. You know, how do those three things intersect in the way that you see these careers develop?
I thought about that a lot, actually. And I think part of what we lost, and this happens with NASA, it happens with the military. I understand that there's an economic, you know, bottom line, but there's certain things that you can't really quantify. But if you are the top math or top scientist or the, you know, the prestige that also went along with working at NASA, mm-hmm, meant something where it could supplement the salary, because you weren't necessarily going to get rich there. But to say I worked at NASA, I helped put Neil Armstrong on the moon, I was part of Apollo 13 and I got those guys home. That meant something. It meant something more than money although money's nice, but it meant something. It meant I'm doing my part. So just like it's a part of service. And I don't know whether that becomes NASA or maybe something else, but I think it starts with, as a country, we have to start putting prestige and start putting honor to service, any service of any type, whether it's in uniform, whether it's doing calculations, whether it's in the lab. When somebody is serving and sacrificing probably financial gain for the betterment of the nation, that's the part that has to be developed, I think. And whether that's a NASA or the next organization, or even if it stays private, just the recognition and the appreciation and the acknowledgement of that, and that then comes the support. So people that are doing things like studying crops, for space agriculture, there should be a reference for that. There should be an appreciation and a support of that, so that people can be encouraged to explore these things and try different avenues of trying to grow things, or trying AI, or trying to make the next autonomous rover, or all these different things. It's not that I don't think that we've lost our creativity. I think that the reward system in the country is different than it was during, our heyday in the 50s, 60s, in that era, when 70s, when we were competing, we all had one kind of focused singular goal. I think after the Cold War, it's great that it was over, but we were so focused on being the best and defeating communism that it kind of galvanized us. Like, I would say, similar to World War II, how that galvanized the country.
Yeah, very much so.
When we get focused as a country and as a nation, and put, whatever differences or things that we don't have alike, and get focused on where we're similar. Most of us love our family. Most of us just want to have, the nice things, and we want to feel safe and secure. And how you feel safe and secure? By making sure that you're the best. And to be the best, you have to encourage these, strange things, things that people say are weird. Oh, what are you doing with those plants? And why are they in water? And where is the soil? And, why do you have those lights? But that's how things are going to have to grow in space, if you're going to be there for a long time, or if we're going to really go to Mars, or, do some of these longer explorations. So encourage being different, what some other, that person is, well, they're not weird, they just think differently. But if you're going to live in space for 5 years, you should think differently.
Oh, yeah. No, Brandon, I got to ask you, how long have you been at Tuskegee now?
I've been here for about 5-6 weeks.
Wow. So the reason I ask is because, I worked when I was at AFIT, we worked with a lot of other universities. And I did some work with Tuskegee. And I would say one of the things that seems that you've inculcated or brought with you to the university that fits Tuskegee well is, I always felt there was a very strong sense of pride among the people, the students and the faculty there in the work that you were doing. Yeah. And by bringing that to the space, to space work as a career path, and, not the people that are going to be flying. Everyone gets that, the sense that those on the front of the rocket are the heroes, but it's all the people behind them that you're talking about now. And if we're going to build systems to do that, they've got to get a sense of that. It's sort of what NIDS is doing, right? We want people to be proud that they're part of a deterrence, part of the national security. And you're saying the same thing for space. And that's why I said we're a kindred spirit. I don't know if I said that now or in a show prep, but we are. We are so close. That's why we're happy to have you on board with us. And was this program started before you got to Tuskegee, or is this sort of a new direction?
I wouldn't say it's a new direction, because like you said, historically, and it's just something about this place, like the building that I'm sitting in was actually constructed by Booker T. Washington and some of the students that he first taught. So the creative energy and the vibes that are you know, floating all over this place, or they probably jump on you. But the biggest thing that Booker T. Washington taught was self-reliance and self-teaching, and then giving back to whatever your community is, whatever your surrounding area is, and contributing, you know, whatever your part is. And that's kind of, when you talk about a pipeline of any type of, you know, whether it's any type of STEM, let's just call it STEM. It doesn't just start with having experts. You know, you have to have younger people, then you have to have infrastructure. You have to have parents that are going to bring you to STEM camp when you were, you know, when you're 12, or, you know, robotics camp, or, you know, whatever it is. It takes a whole community of understanding. We're trying to get to this goal. We're trying, so we need to bring our kids along, and we need to support them. And that's the kind of the model that probably has jumped on me a little bit, is that process of support and just community of, and that's what I was kind of talking about with the nation. Like, when the nation kind of has really thrived, we've had that sense of community, and everybody was working towards this one goal, and we're doing it. And that means we're putting a priority on it. So that's why we're getting beat in math and science, because we're not stressing it. We're not stressing the fundamentals, sure. The algebra, you know, the algebra two, the geometry. We're not focused on that right now. And that's why by the time you get to college, it's extremely difficult to try to get people into math and science at that point. It's difficult, and the classes are hard, and you have to have a whole different program for that to get people caught up.
If you're behind going into college, then you're playing catch up from the very beginning. Yeah. And a lot of students do, but it's a lot nicer to walk in sort of along with the crowd, or, you know, where the faculty expects you to be. But, you know, again, I saw a lot of that, you know, when I went to Tuskegee and worked with the folks there. That was valuable. Sounds like you're a good fit there. I want to return to the sort of the food concepts, because I know that is a big piece. And I know, bioregeneration in space, and, you know, being able to actually, you know, make your own food, et cetera, if we're going to put people in space for long-term missions. But I'm curious, as you look at the selling point of this, not everyone is going to get into the space world, but they may work in these areas. Food sustainability is also important here in the United States. You know, when we look at resilience of our country and the potential for, you know, someone bringing in some sort of virus or some other insect or whatever that could take over our food, and then there'd be some food insecurity. So how do you connect those two? And do you do that actively, or there are other organizations that are doing that to try to bring that out as you do the research?
Well, ASCE is the one that is going to publish this work. So
what's ASCE?
Start with them. The American Society of Civil Engineers.
Okay, thank you.
ASCE. I would say, though, that the United States, the USDA, I forget what does USDA stand for?
U.S. Department of Agriculture?
Department of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. Well, I can't believe I forgot that. But they do a lot of work, they sponsor a lot of research. They actually sponsored a building that's being built right now. We did a ribbon cutting. That was like my first week here. It's called the Carver Genomics Center, and it's connected to another Carver building that's named after George Washington Carver. But this one is focused on researching how to combat germs and different diseases. But I think connecting those two that's like the key to resilience. It's like you said, having that barrier where we don't have to depend on everyone to do this, and making people understand that if it works in space, it can work here. And I keep going back to George Washington Carver, because the things that I keep learning, I learn more of what he did every day, but what he was able to do with just a peanut. I could talk for 20 minutes about the different products, from skincare to paint to all, like, different kinds of things that even to this day, there are buildings here that were painted with what they call Carver shellac that are still painted that color, and it cannot be sanded out of the wood. So, that's not food, but he also went around and taught all the farmers here tricks of the trade of how to get, you know, better crops. And they actually have here at the museum some of his crops. And when you would think that it was something at State Fair, the onions and the sweet potatoes and everything is humongous. And it's all
making organic. Me hungry.
Yeah, man. I mean, just it's unreal. So being able to transfer that kind of thought process and that ingenuity to somebody, if somebody is studying the soybean and they can figure out, you know, how to do all of this. And besides just food, if they're up there, they might be able to make medicine or, you know, something, some type of a body care, like all this. Just we don't know what we can do. We just have to keep pushing. And that's kind of like the point of doing this kind of research and keep pushing. And sometimes necessity is the mother of all invention. But taking that same like fervor, even when there's not necessarily a need for it, but just really pushing it and seeing how far it can go is what the USDA is supporting. And then now schools and programs are focusing on this and really using this as a way to leverage their research power. And hopefully the Carnegie research graders will start recognizing this type of research as just as valuable when they're grading, you know, R1, R2, and classifying levels of research.
The national security implications, as well as the even human development issues. You know, we still have parts of the world, the globe, that, you know, do not have a sustainable food output for a variety of reasons. I think there's enough food in the world, this distribution and keeping it, you know, keeping food from going bad or being able to sustain it. But when you think about it in space, you know, let's just say I actually was talking to an organization the other day who was talking about the potential for us putting bases on the moon and working, you know, working from the moon. How do you survive on the moon? And if you can't create your own food, you know, you got to ship it up there every time. It's a non-starter. You got to be able to, but one disease can take you out. I mean, that's the problem. So how do you look at that from a global standpoint and then applying it to some very closed form universe, if you will, called a moon base that basically is its own, you know, separate, you know, universe in terms of its biology?
Yeah, I think that 2020 kind of put us on an understanding of how, you know, how that if we ever have to get to that type of point. But I think not just that, but that takes more people research in life science and the interaction, you know, what happens as, you know, humans are interacting and what's causing these things to pass from one another, or how can we leverage AI to analyze or use, you know, we have all these different cameras and different sources of data, but we don't have a data problem. We have an interpreting the data problem. So
sometimes too much data problem.
Yeah, too much data. So figuring out what the data means, what data is important. I think like that type of automation is just as important as like, you know, a robot moving or having a robot build something, but actually trying to teach the our AI tools or our technology to be smart enough to help us identify indicators. It's probably the best way to say it. What are the indicators? We don't need you to define it, but just help me, give me an alarm, or hey, that's an indicator, you might want to look at that. But that takes a lot of research, and it really takes some collaboration, because the people who can probably program that aren't the people who would think of what the indicators are. So I think that's another kind of challenge that kind of touched on, but needs to be further researched. It's we need to start doing some cross-pollination and in areas that we wouldn't necessarily think of. So, you know, farmers and programmers, that kind of stuff to really, you know, it's some combinations that we wouldn't think of. So we're not talking, you know, peanut butter and jelly. We're more like peanut butter and mushrooms, you know, marshmallows or something like that. Like, things we wouldn't think of. it's a different kind of combination.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. And yeah, bringing them together, you know, getting people to cross fertilize, you know, because everybody loves what they do. I like being an engineer because, you know, engineering physics is sort of a very broad field. You can touch other places. But too often people miss out on taking advantage of maybe a mathematician's view on something, a theoretical person versus a computational person versus experimental person. They look at the world differently. And a lot of people don't, you know, unless you're in the science world, you don't realize that, you know, our brains, you know, we form, you know, from young age and when we go through education, we form to look at things a similar way based upon what we've had in the past. But I might look at something completely different from you. Which is sort of an interesting way to look at science, and so in this discussion, I think it's really important. You know, as one of the things I was thinking about as you were talking though, is you're talking about the people coming in and sort of the education, you know, how the secondary education and how you get them into post secondary education and beyond. Now you've only been there for 5 weeks, but from your assessment, you know, what is the difficult part of getting people sort of excited about this? To say we're going to work on crop formation, but we're going to do this for a space base, or we're going to do it for defining a global pandemic or some sort of problem where you have a global loss of water or whatever, or excess water, whatever. We have to still create crops. How do we go about doing that with weather change or climate change? However you want to look at it. How do you catch the people? What are you going to do?
That is a challenge. That I've been thinking about that a lot, and I'm going to keep going back to this. I keep going back to the blueprint. So one big thing that Booker T. Washington taught everybody was that the quality of a wall is only as good as the brick that you make, but then the way you lay the brick. So what I'm trying to explain, to the younger people and to some administrators and some teachers, is making them understand how the two are connected, because everyone can understand once the wall is built and say, oh, there's a wall. But when you're coming with the clay and you're saying, hey, I got an idea and this can be a wall, it takes a little bit more for them to understand what you're talking about. So making them kind of be able to touch the main points of how you get from that, lump of clay to a brick, to a wall, I think that's the key. And how I'm suggesting that we do is that we look at strategic milestones and strategic goals of the nation, of defense, and then we look at our curriculum. We look at our skill sets, we look at the things that we're teaching, and we say, okay, how does this tie into that? Or it might not even be that much of a stretch, but just showing them, hey, you're a part of national security. Even when you're learning about, farming, you're a part of national security when you're learning about cybersecurity, whether you're in that, whether you're in the defense or not, you're part of the defense. You're part of the country's defense. And I think most of the time, I would like to believe that wake something up in people. And we want to all, the majority of us want to be good citizens and good stewards of this this experiment of ours that we've been doing for almost 250 years called the United States. And I think this is actually an opportunity for we had the greatest generation, and right now we don't have anything really cool or honorable to stick our flag on out of, this last, 10 to 15 years. So this could be the time where we really put our stamp on it and help the younger folks really start to identify what it's like, what it means to be an American in 2025, 2030, and 2050 and 2070. And it's just getting back to the basics, getting back to what makes us great. And what has always made us great is that when it got crunch time, we rolled our sleeves up and we got to work and we got studying and we got to thinking and we figured out a way to come up with the solution, whatever the situation was. And this is the same thing. It's just a little more abstract, but it's really the same thing. It's about making sure that, that the country is secure and that we can have a 350th, you know, national holiday. That's the bottom line. So showing them how all of that plays into getting us to that point is it's my strategy and my sales pitch, so to speak.
Wow.
And we'll see how it works.
Well, I mean, you definitely, you know, make me feel, you know, put on my red, white, and blue again and move forward here, because you definitely have the right view. And I agree with it that when we get together, there's very little that can slow us down. It's only when we tear each other apart that we seem to have the difficulties. And you know, bringing in students, and this is what I found in going into high schools, is there's a very short stepping stone to start with, because in our schools, mm-hmm. there's so many things going on in our kids' lives. Our lives have become very complex. Our schools have become complex. They're trying to do many things and trying to get a foothold to say, here's a starting point for building a career. You know, and I'll take a little tangent here for myself, just to give you a connection for our audience. But I became interested in physics not from our school, but because of a neighbor who had a train set. He was working on model trains, and he was my age. He was older than me, actually, at the time. He had tuberculosis. He couldn't move around, and he needs someone to help him to hook up his tracks by running wire to his railroad tracks. And I found it so fascinating to do that. Wow. I got into electronics, which got me into physics, which got me into, you know, an interest. And sometimes it takes that little spark, and it sounds like you're trying to build that spark through the space initiative, which is not just a train set space initiative, but it is truly a real initiative that brings our country together over a focused mission of either deep space exploration or, you know, as I read through some of the concepts in your paper, deep exploration or maybe national security, basing spaces, you know, having space-based operations and beating our adversaries to that punch so that we get the drive of the mission space instead of them. All of that keeps us safe. All that keeps us secure, keeps us at peace, and provides us our freedoms. And that's what we're looking at as an organization. It sounds like you're bringing that to Tuskegee, or it's part of maybe Tuskegee's, you know, culture anyway. You know, we're past.
I think I'm bringing a little bit of NIDS. I think I'm bringing a little bit of NIDS with me, because it's my getting involved with NIDS made me start to think of all the things that were related to deterrence that weren't. You know, traditional or necessarily what you would think, you know, weapons and all that kind of ammunition. Like, and that's why people need to watch the podcast and stay tuned and go to the website, because it gets you thinking. And that's what I actually explained to some architecture students that were, you know, doing projects. And I said, well, why couldn't you do that if that was under a glass dome? But then have you thought about what type of glass or what kind of material would it be? And that's why we need to have a lab. And that's why we have to do strength of materials. That's why you're in the strength of materials lab, so that you can understand how all of these different elements and all these different, you know, materials, how they work. We're trying to find out how they work. It's just how they work in space. It's the only difference. And they were all looking like, oh, okay.
Yeah, well, that's great. It's great we've had an influence on you and hopefully your students. But again, it's your desire to do that, and that's what's really good. Now, we've run against the hour. I'm gonna have to close out soon. But I've been holding on to one question. I really want to hear what you have to say. Most of our audience has probably seen the movie The Martian. In fact, our newspaper in Dayton Daily News has just given a full page review of some of the things that came out in the movie. Have you seen it?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. I'm not getting any royalties or anything else. I'm just curious about your thoughts on that, because you mentioned food, and I think the most surprising piece of that movie is when he goes in and tries to grow those potatoes and using human feces to grow the potatoes in that movie. And then of course the disaster that followed later where he kills them off with a, you know, because of the temperature and the destruction of the facility. So I'm just curious, do you use that at all? Or is that, Is that something that, that had any inspiration or ideas that came to you?
I think, yes, actually, because obviously the growing and the farming part, but I think more than that, it was his ability to problem solve. Because if you think about it, now he had some special skills, but at the end of the day, he was going through the basic, you know, scientific method or going through an assessment. He did a sit rep and he said, okay, here's my issue. This is what I got. Here are my resources and this is what I need. And what's my, you know, what are my number one needs? Food, water, and air. And he figured out a way to try to address those. And I think teaching that type of thought and that way of learning something is where we got to do better. We have to challenge the students and we have to make them think, because as we both learned, when you get to the real world, it's not in the problems. It's not the problems that you learned in the book, and it's never this perfect situation. It's always some conditions on a site that are not in the book. And that's how we should be teaching, so that we can be more agile and just more free in our thinking and our problem solving. So yes, yeah. The long answer to say yes, that made me think of that, but just how he would think about things and really, you know, look around and take whatever he could use. And that's what we had to do. We had to just take what we can use and figure out how to be the best.
Excellent. No, that's a great way to close this out. Well, Brandon, I thank you. You know, if you inspired me, I'm going to, you know, one of my first internet searches after we're done with this show is to look up Booker T. Washington quotes, because the, you know, your brick analogy was a spot on. It's one I want to use again and again. It makes a lot of sense, but I'm sure there's many, many more. And
there are.
And you, you're really inspirational in the way you talk about your science and your background, but also in what you're trying to do. And I applaud you for what you're trying to do with your students there, as well as for the nation. And so, and of course, your work with NIDS, you certainly are one of our hard charging experts, and we appreciate that. So
thank you.
Thanks again. So we're going to close this out for all today's right. show. Again, if you get a chance, come listen to us. We have GSR articles. We are still, you know, doing our podcasts are still out there. Our HUSI events on Fridays. You know, contact us at nids@thinktoturns.com. Ask us about what we're doing. And if you like what we're doing, tell your friends, tell your neighbors, tell your colleagues, get them to listen. The more listeners we have, the more people are interested in us, the more we can sponsor bigger things and better things. Who knows, maybe Brandon will have his own podcast at NIDS on the space moon base when he figured out how to do it. So you never know. So with that, we're going to close out. Thanks again. This has been a great week and a great podcast. And hopefully we'll bring you on the show again sometime, Brandon. Hopefully I can get down to Tuskegee again. I really enjoyed my time down there.
We love to have you.
All right. Well, thank you. And with that, as always, we want you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.